This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A few years ago, UNC sociology professor Judith Blau and her TA Rafael Gallegos were at the Abbey Court apartment complex in Carrboro. They're passing out flyers on behalf of a Latino cultural organization called El Centro when they were nearly run off by the police. Judith began to connect the dots. And here was a place that had a high density of immigrants who needed support and services. It also had the highest crime rate in Carrboro and a hostile relationship with police. So Judith Blau thought instead of passing out flyers, she would start a nonprofit. She rented an apartment at Abbey Court, opened the Chapel Hill and Carrboro Human Rights Center. Today, the center occupies two apartments and has a thriving after-school program as well as many other projects. Judith Blau and Rafael Gallegos are in the studio today, along with Nancy Hilburn, who runs the after-school program at the Human Rights Center. And I want to welcome all three of you to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
Judith, let me start with you and ask about the Human Rights Center. How did it get started?
I had been teaching a theory course on human rights, which for an American student body is very abstract. And I was kind of thinking of how we could apply that when Raphael and I went to Abbey Court, and I turned to him and said, "This is it."
Why did you go to Abbey Court in the first place?
To distribute flyers for El Centro.
So you're distributing the flyers, and they were about services that were available to them. What's the connection? When we think of human rights, we usually think in terms of international aid and refugees in distress. What's that got to do with an apartment complex in Carrboro?
Well, human rights, according to international human rights treaties, include the right to dignity, to equality, to food, social security, decent jobs, the rights of the disabled, the rights of migrants. And it's not a vocabulary that we are familiar with in the United States. We charge countries like North Korea with human rights violations, but we don't think of food as being a human right.
So you get to a place like Abbey Court and it clicks. This is it. What then? I mean, that could certainly make more concrete for your students what you're talking about, but you also decided to rent a apartment and get busy in that complex. What were you thinking at the time?
That we would have programs, which we are doing now. There are several campus student groups who provide programs as well as other groups. One of our most ambitious collaborations is with Technology Without Borders, which is a campus group, and they have installed free Wi-Fi throughout most of Abbey Court. Then we secured computers through the school system so that we're trying to close the digital divide.
Raphael, can you describe Abbey Court? Who lives there?
Well, there's some. Primarily, I would say Latino families. A lot of them are young immigrants, also male immigrants. But we also have a small community of Burmese immigrants as well, and there's a lot of working class Caucasian and African American families that live there as well. But I would say, for the most part, everyone who lives there are working class families.
And describe the programs now. So you get an apartment. You went with Judith the first time to distribute those flyers. Now you're going to start a program. How did that go when you just sort of rented an apartment and moved in?
Yeah, the idea, it's, you know, moving into a community where there's a lot of history, it was quite hard. And I think that if we wanted for the residents to take us seriously, you know, we had to become part of the community. And Judith, thinking of a place, you know, she figured that this probably would be the best place to do that. And we went ahead and contacted a private owner. One of the differences from Abbey Court with other apartment complexes is the fact that they do have some private condos. And so that enables us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
private owners, and is it one rental company? Does one company own it all the rest of the apartments, or are there individual owners who rent out their property?
I think that, and I'm not exactly sure about this, but I would say that the large company that manages most of the apartments owns about more than 3/4 mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. it, and there's about 80 private owners.
Nancy, you're doing an after-school program. How did you get started doing that?
Well, I was over there one day in the early evening taking some kids home from an event, and there was a little boy carrying a ball that was maybe bigger than he was. And I had to waste some time because the parents weren't home, so this little boy and I started playing ball. And before I knew it, there were 10 or 15 kids out there playing with me. And I thought, wow, we need to do more of this. So we started, the PE teacher and I started going over there once a week to play after school, and I would go into an apartment to work with some kids on their homework because they were kind enough to invite me in. And I thought, no, we need more of this. We need more space. And we had a reading program under the tree in the summer that one of the teachers at our school started. And then as fate would have it, I was fortunate enough to meet Dr. Blau, and she gave us space to do all that.
And Judith, there was something you noticed about what was happening under the tree that may not have been happening in the apartment.
That's right. This was a wonderful chance encounter. And now my undergraduates on their final papers write about their service learning, and describe how it connects with the human rights and to describe the school. And I always think of Garrison Keillor when I read their answers. All the children are better than average. The undergraduates describe their experiences with the kids as highlighting the kids' talents and abilities and social skills that are really not measured by school tests. I think it's an outgrowth of the kids having to translate for their parents mm-hmm. and living in two different worlds.
Well, Nancy, you teach at Mary Scroggs Elementary School in Chapel Hill, and I think most of the kids at Abbey Court, or if not all, go to Mary Scroggs. Tell us about their experience there and what you learned as a teacher who would perhaps not have seen where they come from. I mean, you'd been a teacher who, you know, waits for them to come through your door at Mary Scroggs. What's the difference for you as a teacher to go into their environment and do this after-school program?
Well, I think the best story comes, there are many, but one of the music teacher came, and the children were so excited she was there, and they brought their recorders and played with her. And the next day at school, she said that one of the children who normally just sat in her class very quiet and unnoticed asked, could I please play in for the whole class? And that is the biggest difference, I think, that we're making. I am just an inclusion facilitator at our school. But through that job, I get to see children of all ages in throughout the school. And it's just delightful to walk down the hall and have these children, you know, want to hug me or say hello to me and to the other teachers who come. They know that this is their school. Their school is in their neighborhood, and they belong to that school.
What is an inclusion specialist?
Well, an inclusion inclusion assistant is a person who assists children who have exceptional needs in the classroom so that they are in the classroom, doing whatever they happen to be doing in the classroom. And so I get to work with kids from K through 5, so I know lots and lots of children.
And there are other teachers then who are now going to Abbey Court working in different programs.
They come to the after-school program we've had, and they come play.
So what? Why does that work? Why does that make a big difference? Why do you suppose that student stood up and said she wanted to play?
I think that child all of a sudden felt comfortable. Like I don't know if it was a he or a she, but I feel like that child belonged and knew or felt that she belonged.
But because suddenly they saw their teacher in their environment.
Yes.
So they're one of us, and there's a connection and an identity.
I believe so. Our school is a beautiful school, and it's in a neighborhood that is predominantly, I think, affluent and white. And the school was built smack dab in the middle of it. And so the children in that neighborhood can walk to school, or, you know, our children live a few miles away from the school and are driven in on a bus. So it wasn't really their school in the same sense that it was to those who live in the surrounding neighborhoods who can walk. And so we wanted it to be. The administration, the teachers, everybody was very interested in supporting these children and making this school their school.
Raphael, you mentioned something earlier about how difficult it was to gain trust, and I understand that things started to change once Nancy showed up and sat under the tree. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the process of gaining trust and, you know, what that taught you?
Yes. One of the initial programs that Dr. Bly and I wanted to do when we first went to Ivy Court is to begin to help a group of men who gather outside Ivy Court who are day laborers. We felt that, you know, perhaps them having families in Ivy Court, you know, were also struggling because there is difficulty finding a job. But as we began to do work with them, we realized that it's much more difficult to help someone like that, you know, to find someone a job. It requires, you know, skills that we didn't possess at the time or the connections that we didn't have. But then as we get to begin to work with Nancy and begin to see that, you know, there's a lot of kids there who belong to the same family and who have needs that perhaps we can't help with. And after working with Nancy, you know, in the after school program, we noticed that families begin to see the center as a place that they can trust, a place where, you know, if their kids are taken care of and they're assisted, perhaps they could be. And I think from this wonderful relationship with the community, other programs have emerged, such as ESL programs for adults. We have computer programs for adults. We now have some food distribution. And I think that being there and working with the children have validated, you know, the work that we do in the eyes of the community.
Let me add to that to say that Raphael has done a lot of legal work because the day laborers are frequently gypped. It's called wage theft.
Mm-hmm.
And it's contrary to national law, but, you know, the day laborers are scared to go to court. And he represents them. And we also work with lawyers. Something that I'm really so pleased about is that our neighbors now are helping to run some of the programs.
Mm-hmm.
The food distribution on Saturday, a day laborer and I are primarily responsible for that. And the computer lab is run by a day laborer who has ingenious computer skills. So he is a very popular place to go in the evening.
Well, some of the other changes, safe to say the relationship with the police was not very good, given your experience just trying to hand out flyers when you first started.
Yes.
Has that changed?
Yes. Raphael and I had a meeting yesterday with the chief of police, and it's a sharing of concerns and of information.
Yeah, I think when we first arrived to Ivy Court, I think that was one of the main concerns that we've initially had at Ivy Court because, you know, being there, handing flyers and had the police come and escort us out of the property was a big red flag. And you can only imagine that a lot of the stories that we have heard in the past about Ivy Court that we read in the newspapers then sort of begin to have a more real meaning. And I think that after being there and being able to work with city officials and being able to be a link between the community and the police department or the just the city, mm-hmm. I think has helped because has been able to provide this you know, public organizations more of a context of what Ivy Court is all about and not just by what the media portrays as. And I think in that sense, a lot of the residents have now feel empowered in that they can talk to some of the police or they have asked for meetings with some of the city officials and we have done that. And I think that many of them have spoke about some of the things they're dealing with, some of the problems at Ivy Court. But I feel that if we didn't feel that we had the support of the city, we wouldn't be able to do any of the things that we do.
But what changed? Were you mediating conversations between the police and the community, or how did that actually come about, this new relationship between the community and the police?
It seems like to me that in the past, I mean, at least for what I understand, before we went into Abbey Court, there was no such a thing as that. I mean, so most of the Carver police do not speak Spanish. So there was a big language barrier and cultural barrier. And I think that having some of the people that work with us and beginning to be able to make that connection and being able to have residents talk directly to police officers with our assistance, I think that opened a lot of channels of communication. And I think that they became more trusting, because one of the things that we kept talking to the community is that the police department in Carver in general is pretty good. And they're very understanding. And I think people can see that. But now that there's a way to communicate with them, I think they feel more comfortable there.
Another aspect of what we do is to petition the two towns to adopt resolutions. They both have adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And they both have adopted resolutions about fair trade. So we will continue to do this because it raises public understanding and conceptions of what human rights are, and it fulfills our mission of being a nonprofit organization for both towns.
Well, how does that change life for people materially? You talked about human rights being food security. Well, that's one of the human rights. It's something we do not guarantee in this country and would put us in violation, I guess, of human rights.
That's right. Some cities like San Francisco and Chicago and New York City are pushing resolutions like this in order to encourage towns to enact ordinances or work with private employers. It's a process. It's not easy. At the present time, we have a resolution for both towns for a human rights commission.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it wouldn't necessarily mean, let me get your thought on this, that you would pass this resolution and let's take food security as one of these provisions that we now feel bound and obligated to honor. It doesn't mean you're going to parachute food, drop food on Abbey Court, right? It means let's figure out a way to make sure that the people who live here are able to make a living and feed themselves. That's what that means, and not food drops. This isn't, World War II, the Marshall Plan you're talking about.
Well, I think that we do a little bit of that right now. We have two programs in which we actually, there's an organization that brings bags of food every Friday. And that primarily goes to the children in the after school. We also try to go on every Saturday to the farmers market, and we bring all the items that the farmers donate. So, knowing that we're in a difficult economic situation, food scarcity it's pretty much more widespread. But I think that one of the important things is that we begin to also change the culture in Abbey Court in the sense that, because many of them have not felt included into the community. Now they feel that perhaps they can go in and maybe ask for assistance or try to find out where they can get assistance in this way.
How have things changed in school, Nancy, in terms of the way the school views those students and the way those students feel in school?
I just think the level of comfort for those students has risen remarkably, and I think the awareness of teachers has maybe grown some, although... And the teachers are remarkably supportive. The administration's supportive. I think there's this sense that we are all here to support each other. And
well, is there going to be an effort to actually measure the progress in terms of end of grade scores and all these other quantitative things that people care about when they look at tests?
That's always the big question. And our program is a homework help program. We had a mother who would take her child's homework to work with her and ask her coworker to explain how she could explain it to her child. And so ours is just simply a homework help program. We haven't targeted some of the other things that we might, but I certainly want to do that soon because I think we can.
Judith, I am flat out of time, but is there going to be an attempt to replicate this in other places?
Well, I think we're developing a model that can be replicated in other communities and other towns, and we'll start writing that up.
We're looking forward to it. Thank you all. Judith Blau, Rafael Gallegos, and Nancy Hilburn, Chapel Hill Carrboro Human Rights Center. For more information, go to humanrightscities.org. Coming up next, happy birthday. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Tal Farlow of Greensboro, a retrospective after this. Stay tuned.